more profound aspect of right view, which is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And as I said, that is mostly, in the end, it's reserved for the Aryans, for the noble ones, the ones who have penetrated the Dhamma fully. But now we're going to move on to the more ordinary right view. Now, there is a very close relationship between the noble right view of the Four Noble Truths and the ordinary right view. They're basically the same thing, but looking at it from a more profound and a less profound viewpoint. So this is the, and because this is for more ordinary people, for the non-Aryans, it means that this particular right view is very relevant, essentially for everybody, right? This is the thing where you can ask yourself whether you are in alignment with these things, and if not, whether you can maybe improve your practice, improve your viewpoint on these particular issues. So this gets very practical, very much something that all of us can benefit from, this particular right view. And this is taken from Majjhima Nikaya 41, the Brahmins of Sala, the Salayaka Sutta in the Pali. And this is just a tiny extract. This is the 10 courses of wholesome actions that are being explained here. The Dasakusala Kamapata is called in Pali here. And this is just a short summary of right view, and then we will go into the various aspects later on here. So this is how it is defined. He has right view and distorted vision. Thus, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. So that is right view, and perhaps it seems a little bit cryptic when you just kind of read this. It's very short, right? It's kind of tiny little phrases are kind of thrown together in this way. And not very obvious, perhaps, what exactly is meant here. But the first point here is that he has right view, undistorted vision. Undistorted is aviparita or something like that. It means that your vision, basically, it is in accordance with the reality. It's not distorted. It's not different from how the world actually operates. Right? So you align your view with the world, with how the world works. So you don't act out of wrong view. That is basically the idea here. And then the first thing that comes up here, very interesting. The very first thing of right view is that there is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. This is the very first thing. Well, the first thing perhaps I should comment on, why does it say given, then offered, then sacrificed? Why does it talk about three things like that? Does it mean that there are three different things? Or what is actually the meaning of this? And this is one of the things, kind of basic things of the Pali Suttas, because remember, this is oral literature, right? At the time in India, when the Buddha was around, everything, any teaching was always oral literature. It was passed from generation to generation orally. And because it's oral, there are certain ways that oral literature is built up. And one of the ways it is built up is through repetition. Because repetition, if you have the same meaning, the same idea, phrased in different ways, right? It is much more likely that it will not get distorted because you have the same idea phrased in many different ways. It's like you're reinforcing a certain idea. And this is something you see throughout the sutta, this idea of repetition. So we don't have to read too much into this thing. It doesn't mean that there are necessarily three different things. There is only one thing, and that is the idea of generosity that is talked about here. There's just three ways of talking about the idea of generosity. Anyway, that's the way I understand this, and because this is something you see throughout the suttas, in a sense. But then, right, then generosity, the first factor of right view here, ordinary right view, is the idea that there is what is given. Right? What does that mean? There is what is given. And To understand that, you have to look at the kind of the overall feel for this right view. And a lot about the right view here is about karma and vipaka, the results of karma. It's also about this world and the other world, right? So the idea here, presumably what is meant by there is given, is that giving has effect, giving has force, giving is good karma, giving is important on the Noble Eightfold Path.
That is what it actually, what it means. It is in the framework of karma and in the framework of the idea of rebirth that you can understand what the idea of offering and giving actually means here. It is something very powerful, right? In fact, it is so powerful that it is singled out as one of the factors of right here. If you haven't got the idea that giving is important, that generosity matters, it means you are hindering the progress, your progress on the Noble Eightfold Path. That is how important it is, and that is why it is singled out in this way at the very beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. Remember what I was saying yesterday, that these factors, they build on each other, right? So once you have the first factor in place, the second factor comes into being as a result of that, and it goes all the way to samadhi as a consequence. So for that reason, these basic things here are very important, because if you establish those in the right way, it means the path tends to work by itself. It just works through. So these things are therefore very important and essential things to recognize. So there is what is given. Giving, generosity, is one of the foundations of the Buddhist path. And not only do you see that here, but you see that there's another paragraph, or whatever you want to call it, in the suttas, that talks, which often called the Anupubbakata, right? The gradual, how the path is spoken about, or the Buddha, the gradual kind of talk, where you bring the person through a series of statements until eventually they attain stream entry. And that too starts with dana, with generosity here. So you find that this generosity is often at the foundation level of the Buddhist path. And it is so important that here it is placed as part of right view. And as the practice matures, as your generosity becomes more powerful, then there comes a point when that generosity becomes so strong. This is kind of why it is so important. As you approach the jhanas, as you approach samadhi, as you approach the deep insight into stream entry and these things, it says you can only achieve these things if your generosity has been perfected. Right? You have to have this openness of the heart, this willingness to give to anybody, this incredible kind of feel, this want, this desire to be generous. And when you have that desire, and you feel this generosity inside of you, that is when samadhi becomes possible. If you haven't got that, if there's some kind of holding back, some kind of stinginess, a little bit of holding back in a certain area, wherever it might be, samadhi becomes impossible. So in a sense, we are, by doing generosity here, you are preparing yourself for having the ability to enter samadhi and the ability to also become a stream enter and get the deep insights on the path later on. So generosity is so important. I want to talk about generosity later on, probably spend one session just talking about generosity. It is important for monastics and lay people. Sometimes it's easy to think that generosity is a practice for lay people, and of course that there is that relationship between the Sangha and the lay Buddhists, which kind of makes that natural in a certain way. But also, as monastics, it's also we need to have that openness of the heart, that willingness to share, willingness to give, has to be part of our practice as well. Otherwise, the path is going to stop. Okay, so I'll come back to that later on. The second one then is, there is fruit and result of good and bad actions. Right? There is karma. If you do bad, you have to reap the results. If you do good, you will reap the results of that. That is basically all it is. It is this idea of karma vipaka. There are results of what we do. And if you don't believe in that, well, it's very likely that you will do all kind of mischief. There is the famous, in the Samanyapala Sutta, the talk about the various views of the various heretical, the various sectarian teachers at the time of the Buddha. And one of those teachings was that there is no karma, there is no result of good and bad actions. And it specifically says, if you go on the north bank of the river Ganges and you slaughter and kill everything, right? Somebody had, I think, some kind of, if you have a razor-rimmed wheel, imagine a razor-rimmed wheel, and you use this razor-rimmed wheel to kill and slaughter all the beings on the northern side of the river Ganges, you have done nothing bad, according to this one teacher. And then if you go on the southern bank of the river Ganges, then you give out, you hand out to people, you do acts of generosity, you have done nothing good. Right? This is the kind of view that some teachers had in those days. This was actually propounded as a view. And you can imagine the effect, right? If it actually is true what the Buddha says, that there is karma, and you come up with this kind of view, it's going to be... It is very terrible if the world is one way and you have the exact opposite view. It's going to lead to very, very bad consequences as a result. And that's why these things are mentioned here, of course. I just like that those ideas about kind of walking around on the north and the south bank of the river Ganges and kind of either being ultra-generous or being extremely nasty and then saying, oh, there's no problem at all. Nothing to worry about. So that is the idea of karma. I will talk more about karma later on and probably do a full session on that because it is very worthwhile to look at that more deeply. The ideas of karma are actually much more nuanced than what we often regard them as. Then we have the next one. There is this world and there is the other world, Iddaloka and Paraloka. And this refers in the Buddhist teaching to the fact that there is rebirth, right? When you die from this world, you go on to another world afterwards. It doesn't end here. Iddaloka. Idda means here, this world. Paraloka. So the idea of rebirth, too, is absolutely central. And this is something I also will look at in a fair amount of detail later on. And because the point of this is right view. So the point of this is really to get a feeling for these things, right? Remember, right view is not just about saying, yeah, yeah, I believe in rebirth, whatever. That's not going to take you very far. But what does it actually mean? What does it feel like? If there really is such a thing as rebirth, what does that feel like? You know, imagine that you actually see that there is life after life after life. How would you feel if you saw that? And of course, the point is that the way the Buddha talks about that, when he talks about his own awakening experience, it has a tremendous impact. He's not the Buddha quite yet. He's getting very close to becoming the Buddha. Has a tremendous impact on him when he actually sees rebirth. It is so strong that becomes a spur to his awakening experience. So that is really, it should have a strong impact. And the more impact it has, the more we have understood what these ideas are about. Then the next one. There is mother and father, right? There is mother and father. I remember reading this for many years, reading there is mother and father. And I thought, yes, of course, there's mother and father. And then I would just kind of move on to the next one, right? Without really thinking about it. Because it's so, yes, there is mother and father. But obviously, if it is here, it means something. It doesn't just mean that there is mother and father. Everybody knows that. It must mean something more, So what does it mean? And again, of course, the context here is karma and rebirth, the idea that there are results on good and bad actions. So when it says that there is mother and father, it means that our parents are very powerful fields, either for doing good or for doing bad. That is what the context suggests that this means. In fact, it is so important, again, that it is placed as part of right view. This is kind of the astonishing thing, that you find these things as part of right view. That's how important it is. In other words, if we don't do what we can for our parents, if we don't kind of maximize the opportunity for doing good in regard to our parents and avoiding bad things, then we are again slowing down the progress on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is how important it is. So these little things, right, which actually are very, very meaningful, come out here. And I will talk more about mother and father, idea of mother and father later on. But In a sense, it fits very well with the rest of the Buddha's teachings, because the Buddha says also that if you kill one of your parents, one of the Antarayika Dhammas, you have a very bad rebirth as a consequence of that. So there is many things in the suttas which suggest that the karma that we create in regard to our parents is very strong and very powerful. But I'll get back again to that later on. Then we have the next one. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. And this is perhaps the only factor here which is a little bit difficult to understand why it is there. And in fact, if you look at the Chinese version of this little verse, this little paragraph, I think that is the only one which is missing from the Chinese. So again, if you do comparative studies and you look at the Chinese compared with the Pali, that is the one that is missing. So perhaps it is possible that this one is not as important since it is missing from the Chinese. But anyway, what does it mean? So because the idea here, because the context is karma and rebirth, I would say the meaning is that if you have spontaneously arisen beings, it means that you are expanding the scope for karma to ripen, right? If you are in the human realm and you have a physical body, within the human realm, happiness and pleasure is defined within certain limits, right? Once you go to the animal realm, you kind of expand on the suffering side a lot. So happiness and suffering has certain limits in the human realm. Once you add the animal realm, it expands a lot. But to be able to experience happiness and suffering in a much wider range, like the jhana range, and get reborn accordingly, and perhaps even to talk about hell beings and the suttas as well, right? To be able to experience the full range of happiness and suffering in the world, you have to have a different kind of body. This physical body we have is not suited for experiencing that kind of happiness and pleasure. So by adding in spontaneously arisen beings, you are expanding the scope for happiness and pleasure, so we can include all the realms in samsara. Instead of just having this tiny little human realm, it's like, whoa, you expand it out. And that is what I think the meaning of this is, and why it is included here. So, yes. And then we come to the last one, and the last one is that there are good and virtuous, it says here. This is sammagata, sammapatipanna. I don't know why that is translated as good and virtuous, because sammapatipanna means someone who has practiced rightly, right? So there are good and there are recluses and Brahmins who have practiced rightly and who have done what is right. That's basically what it means in the world, who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. And this is, in a sense, the foundation stone for Buddhism. If you are going to become a Buddhist, you have to believe that the Buddha or somebody has understood or realized something. You have to believe, you have to have some kind of faith, some kind of confidence that the Buddha has some kind of insight into the world that matters. If you haven't got any confidence in the Buddha, right, then you don't even get started on this path. This is kind of the most basic of all right views, is the idea that the Buddha has discovered something worthwhile. If you haven't got that, nothing happens at all. It is completely out. So you have to have this faith that there are someone in the world who has understood more than what you have. And of course, that is primarily the Buddha that we are talking about. And you can see here again, what you have confidence in is not just anything. What you have confidence in is that they have understood by direct knowledge this world and the other world. Rebirth, right? Rebirth is that foundational understanding. So when somebody comes to you and says, there is rebirth, when the Buddha says there is rebirth, that is basically what we have to place confidence in. So again, very, very important. So, that is the, in brief, the ideas of what is the mundane right view. Now I'm going to go through this. I'm going to start today and at least all of tomorrow, perhaps more as well, to look at these various aspects in much more detail. And I want to start with the last one, the idea that there are well-practiced and well gone recluses and Brahmins in the world who have realized this world and the other world. I want to start with that because that is the very foundation for basically the entire path. And this next sutta is about that. I didn't mention this sutta already. I will go through it for that reason fairly quickly. But it is a nice sutta, and I think an important one. And there are certain lessons to be drawn from this particular sutta. And this is from the Magga Samyutta, the second sutta called Half the Holy Life. And this is how it reads. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. Not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the noble eightfold path. Okay, so I will stop there. You can see it ties in directly with the Noble Eightfold Path, right? What we're doing. And again, the point is that without that good friend, this is the Kalyana Mitta, right? The importance of the Kalyana Mitta. Without that noble friend, you don't even get started. You don't even practice this Noble Eightfold Path. Just as an aside, I like this translation here. The good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship, right? Comrade is like the word that they used in Eastern Europe, especially the Soviet Union, the comrades, right? It sounds like some kind of leftover from the communist era when you read this. I did ask Bhikkhu Bodhi about this. Maybe we can change this word comrade. It sounds a bit strange. But he said, I've looked through all the dictionaries. It's the only word I can find. Friend, companion, and comrade. So we have to use comrade. Okay, we use comrade. This is one of those things about translating, right? It's very, very interesting sometimes. Anyway, that's an aside. So, this is a very famous, very well-known sutta, and it's something that I'm sure you have all heard of. I like to talk about this myself, because it is so striking, right? And it took me a long time to understand this. I always thought 50%, I sort of agreed with Ananda, it makes sense, 50%, yeah? Even 50% sounds like a lot, because there's so many other things to do, right? You have to do the virtue, you have to be generous, you have to have metta, you have to have compassion, you have to be wise, you have to have samadhi, you have to be peaceful, all of these things. So how can Kalyanamitta be so important? And so it took me a long time to really grasp that when the Buddha speaks, he doesn't speak approximately, you know, roughly 100%, or he doesn't exaggerate, right? When the Buddha speaks, he means what he says. And he says that in other discourses, whatever I say, that is what I mean. I don't mince my words, I don't mess around, I speak the truth as it is. So eventually you come to the point when you have to take this seriously. And now, of course, you're beginning to understand why this is so important. It has to do with this whole idea, of course, in Buddhism of anatta, of non-self, of who we are as people, We are conditioned beings. What you are now, the whole experience that we have now, the whole feeling that we have now, comes from somewhere in the past, from past in this life and also from the past in previous lives. And because we are what we have become through conditioning. There is no rudder inside of us. There's nothing inside of us that gives us a clear guidance, that always guides us in the right direction. Like I was saying yesterday, delusion begets more delusion. From delusion comes more delusion. And it just keeps on going. There's nothing to stop that sequence of delusion perpetually reinventing itself. Unless something comes from the outside and says, wait a minute, you have misunderstood. This is to be seen differently. And that is the Kalyanamitta. Nothing begins without that Kalyanamitta. And that is why it is 100% of the holy life. Right? Yeah, I won't go into any more details about that now. It's probably enough because we looked at this a little bit before. But what I would say is that what the consequences of that is that it is very important that we choose our friends in the right way, right? And the Buddha says in this particular sutta, it comes a bit further down, the Buddha himself says that the number one Kalyanamitta is who? The Buddha, right? The Buddha is number one Kalyanamitta. What does that mean? It means that the suttas are the core teachings that we always have to come back to. That is the essence. It doesn't mean we can't listen to anybody else. If that was the case, I shouldn't be sitting here. I should just be reading the sutta straight out. I shouldn't be saying anything else. Of course, we can listen to other teachers. Teachers are able to elucidate certain points, are able to kind of point out certain things. But in the end, it is the teaching of the Buddha that is the gold standard. That is what we have to come back to. And that is why, another reason, there's so many reasons, right, why the Buddha's teaching is so important. This is another reason why they are so important. So come back to these teachings every time. And often we don't understand them fully. That's fine. Then you move on and you come back to it later on. But finally, you get a feeling for what these teachings are all about. So, okay. And of course, if you have that good friend, if you have that Kalyanamitta, then you start developing and cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path, which is this teachings I'm giving here now are all about. So this is how that happens. And how, Ananda, does a bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu develops right view, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. He develops right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. It is in this way, Ananda, that the bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. So, that is there. You have all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And perhaps at this point, the only thing I need to comment on is this idea of based upon seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and maturing in release. This particular sequence is something that you see in a few different places in the suttas. It is similar to what you see at the end of the Anapanasati Sutta, for example. It's a similar kind of idea that you see in several places. And so you build up the Noble Eightfold Path based on these things, right? What does that mean? Well, first of all, seclusion. Seclusion is of two kinds in Buddhism, Kaya Viveka and Chitta Viveka. And Kaya Viveka means that you withdraw, right? You go into the forest, you go to a peaceful place, and then you develop your meditation as a consequence. The Buddha very often, he will say to his monks, he will say, monks, meditate. There are these empty huts. There are these empty places. Go and meditate. Otherwise, you will regret it later on. Right? This is what he says to his monks. So, going to an empty place, like Kaya Viveka, is so important. And that is why the idea of forest monks has always been a very important part of Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings. Right? The idea of withdrawing from society, withdrawing from the villages, and withdrawing from the towns, getting away from sensual pleasures, getting away from the noise and the hustle and bustle of ordinary life. This is why. And it is right there, because seclusion matters on this for the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the higher up on this path you go, especially when it comes to Sammasati and Sammasamadhi, seclusion becomes very important at that particular point. Right? And then, from the Kaya Viveka comes the Chitta Viveka. First of all, you need to seclude yourself physically before it becomes possible to seclude yourself in the mind. And seclusion of the mind means basically the seclusion from the hindrances. Getting away from the hindrances. Getting away from these things that block, are obstacles to the mind. It is only when you withdraw from the world physically, withdraw from sensual pleasures, right, all the enticing things that you see around you in the cities, in the towns, it is only when you withdraw from that and you allow to mind to kind of dry out from the sensuality that it becomes possible to really develop the opposite of sensuality, which is samadhi. Samadhi is almost like the opposite of sensuality. Yeah. So seclusion is the first one, kaya viveka, citta viveka. And based on that, you get these things called dispassion and cessation. And I will look at that more later on. I'm not sure if dispassion is the right translation here. The Pali word is viraga. Viraga has two meanings in Pali. It can mean dispassion in certain contexts, but it can also mean fading away in other contexts. And I think perhaps fading away is the more appropriate translation here. This is what you see in the Anapanasati Sutta. It is based on fading away. Why is that? Because, again, this is about how meditation practice works, right? Meditation practice is based on the fading away of the world. As you meditate, things start to fade away. You close your eyes. Closing the eyes, this is why we close the eyes in meditation practice. You don't have to do that at the beginning, but it's helpful because it helps the world to fade away. There's less input. When there's less input, the mind tends to be more peaceful. That's why you close your eyes in meditation. If you're very restless and very agitated, you don't even have to close your eyes. You can still become more peaceful. Sometimes people ask, do I have to close my eyes? And really, it depends on the situation. But again, the whole purpose here is for things to fade away, right? The body fading away, the senses fading away, even the breath fading away, the whole world kind of fading away, gradually, gradually becoming less and less and less. This is what we experience normally in meditation practice. And the whole path is dependent on that. The path comes into being, comes into existence as a consequence of things fading away and ceasing. Fading away and ceasing, that is what leads eventually to the deep insights on the path. And as things fade away, as things cease, insight happens, and eventually it matures in release. Release here means really the release from craving, right? The release from the defilements, the release from suffering above all. So that is a brief description on what these terms mean as I understand them in this particular context. And we will meet these terms again later on in the Anapanasati Sutta, very similar, and I will perhaps talk about them in a little bit more detail when we get to that point. Okay, so now coming back to the sutta again, and the Buddha says the following here. By the following method too, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. By relying upon me as a good friend, Ananda, beings who are subject to birth are freed from birth. Beings who are subject to old age are freed from old age. Beings who are subject to death are freed from death. Beings who are subject to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. By this method, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. So, the purpose of the living the holy life, the purpose of living the brahmacharya under the Buddha, is fulfilled through Kalyana Mitta. This, of course, is the whole purpose of this, the ending of suffering, the ending of problems. Again, you can see here this sequence, right? Birth, old age, and death. Birth coming first. You are freed from birth. Obviously, it means rebirth. That's the only birth you can be freed from. You can't be freed from the birth that you have already had in this life. The whole path, everything we do, is rooted in Kalyana Mitta. So, again, going back to the idea of right view, this is why it is so important to have this feeling, this understanding that there are people in the world who have seen more than us. And I think it's very important, right? Sometimes people are too perhaps conceited and they think, I will walk the spiritual path on my own. I will do what is right. I will figure out the whole thing by myself. I don't need any support. Sometimes people think like that. And it is very dangerous. I mean, we don't normally think like that in ordinary life. If you want to become a doctor, you don't just start operating on people, right? If you did, people would say, you're crazy. What are you doing? I'm just testing out. I'm just learning as I go along, right? And, of course, that doesn't work. You go to medical school. You learn how to be a doctor. You learn how to use the scalpel. And it takes years and years and years to become a surgeon. I don't know how many years you have to study. 6, 8, 10 years or something like that. First you become an ordinary doctor, then you have to become a surgeon or whatever afterwards. And in all walks of life, whether it is engineering, whatever it is, you have to go through the learning process first of all. And it should be exactly the same thing with the spiritual life. First of all, you go and learn what you can learn in the world. And then if you find out there's nothing much to be learned, okay, then you strike it out on your own and you do what is correct. This is what the Buddha did, right? Remember the Buddha's biography. After he goes forth from the homeless life, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. The first thing he does is he seeks out the teachers, the contemporary teachers of that time in India. He doesn't just go out, sit down under a tree and start meditating by himself. He starts out by learning, first of all. What does contemporary society have to teach me? Alara Kalama, Uddaka Ramaputta. Elsewhere, there are reasons to think he also had other teachers apart from that. So he had a number of teachers. The Buddha-to-be, he was humble, right? He was humble enough to understand, well, why shouldn't I learn what other people have already understood before I take it further? It's only sensible, because otherwise you might be wasting your time. It's a very important idea to have the sense of humility, the sense that there is something to be learned by other people. And then, once you feel you have learned that, then you do whatever it takes and move on from that. So it's I think this kind of humility is an important part of the practice as well. Anyway, so this is then the foundation stone of right view. The next thing I want to look at is the idea of rebirth. And there are some very powerful suttas found, especially in the Samyutta Nikaya, about rebirth. This is called the Anamattagga Samyutta. And it is a large number, I think about 20 or 25 suttas, something like that, all about samsara and how samsara, how vast it is, and how you kind of keep on going round and round, and all the suffering you have as a consequence. So this is real Dhamma, right? This is kind of the Buddha saying it as it is. And for some people it's a little bit too much. They say, oh, I'm not sure if I can deal with that. But if I'm sure that most of you here have no problem in dealing with this because you have been steeped in Buddhism for such a long time. But if there's anyone who feels it is too much, then just take it on board that this is what the Buddha taught and allow it to mature over time if you find it hard to relate to these kind of teachings. So the first one here is called Tears, and this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, the 15th Samyutta, the Anamattagga Samyutta. The third sutta there. This is how it goes. Okay, at Savati. Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, the first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What do you think, bhikkhus? Which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on, through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this, or the water of the four great oceans. As we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in such a way. The stream of tears that you have shed is indeed, as you roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is indeed more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a mother. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the streams of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, the loss through illness. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the streams of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For what reasons? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all formations, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Okay, so that is this sutta, and there are many more of this type of sutta in this particular collection in the Samyutta Nikaya. There is one which has also about the amount of blood you have shed, right, from having your head cut off when you were born as an animal and all these kind of things. That too is more than the water in the four oceans. There's another one about the number of bones you have heaped up, and it's more than a big mountain, the Mount Vepula, one of the big mountains near Rajagaha at that time. And all of these kind of very powerful similes to kind of drive home the amount of suffering that one has experienced traveling through the samsaric cycles, being born here, being born there, back and forth, back and forth. So very strong suttas. And what is important, I think, is to try to get a feeling for what this actually means. Tries to relate to it in the way that you can start to actually feel that this actually is real in a certain way. It is very easy to kind of think of these things and make them into kind of intellectual teachings. But if they are intellectual teachings, they don't really touch us. For these things to have power, they have to touch us emotionally. So it is emotions that drive us in this life, right? Vedana pachaya tanha. It's Vedana, usually translated as feelings, but feelings and emotions are very closely related to each other. The driving forces in life is Vedana. Emotions are what drive us. And because of that, it is important to relate to these things in an emotional way. You can actually feel the impact of these kind of statements. So let us look at this in a little bit more detail. So, because this samsara, right, samsara, this moving on, this traveling, going around and around, this is what samsara is, this endless cycle of birth and death is without discoverable beginning here. This is the first kind of interesting point, right? It's this idea that it is without discoverable beginning here. Very often, most religious teachings around the world, most other religions, they will tell you about the origin of the universe. They will say, the universe started here because then God created the universe. That's what they will say. Or you have other creation myths as well, which do not actually have anything to do with gods, but suddenly something happens and suddenly the universe kind of appears out of nothing. Almost every religion, every teaching, with Buddhism is pretty much the only exception, have some idea of the beginning of the universe when everything started. The Buddha says, and to me this is much more sensible way of looking at things, there is no discoverable beginning. You can't find any beginning, right? You can go back and back and back, and when as you go back, you just find more. You find another cause behind, you know, before the condition of the universe as it is now, and you go back and back in this way, always finding a prior cause, a prior cause, a prior cause, going back in time. And this, to me, makes eminent sense. The idea of a prime cause, I cannot make any rational sense out of myself. And I think a lot of philosophers also look at the world in the same way. So this is the first thing. I think this is one of the great things about Buddhism. It actually makes sense. It makes sense from a kind of rational, philosophical view. It's not just, God came and then everything started. It isn't like that. It sounds like magic to me. God comes and creates the universe. Buddhism is not really like magic. It actually, as far as I can see, makes good sense. And the other thing which is interesting here is that not only does it not have a beginning, it has no discoverable beginning. The Buddha doesn't say it doesn't have a beginning. Why not? Well, presumably because the Buddha can only go back so far. He can go back in time, and he can go back in time to a certain point, but he cannot, you know, he cannot go back. There is a limit to how far back you can go. You can recall backwards and backwards and backwards, but there's always going to be a limit. So all you can ever say is that you cannot discover a beginning. You can never actually say that there is no beginning, because that would mean having to go back infinitely into the past. Nobody, it's impossible to go back infinitely into the past. It doesn't matter whether you are a Buddha or what you are, that is just impossible by its very nature to go back infinitely into the past. So again, it's one of those little things that kind of make the Dhamma sensible, right? There is no discoverable beginning here to the world. So this is the first one. And then the Buddha goes on to say that a first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It's a beautiful little phrase. So the first point cannot be discerned. Why? Because there is no discoverable beginning, right? So that's why no first point can be discerned. Of beings, right? Satta, roaming and wandering, right? In English, this idea of roaming, and I think this is probably why Bhikkhu Bodhi chose this particular term. Roaming has a sense of aimlessness, right? You're roaming around in the forest. It means that you're not really going anywhere specific. You're just kind of randomly walking this way, walking that way. And this is what samsara is like. There's no point. There is no point to it, right? We're not actually going anywhere. We're just going back and forth, being reborn as a human, then spending a little bit of blissful time in the Devaloka, then becoming a dog. I have looked at the dogs here in Sri Lanka. Whoa, what a terrible life that would be to be reborn as one of those dogs. Imagine that. What incredible suffering, right? You experience this incredible suffering. Eventually, you come back to the human realm again. You get a bit of happiness. And it goes around and around. You're not going anywhere. This is pointless, right? And this is the point I think the Buddha is making here. It's just going round and round and round, not going anywhere. And this is so different from how we often experience our life. We experience our lives as very purposeful. You start off when you're a child, you go to school, your parents tell you, if you study hard, then you will go to university. If you go to university, you will get a nice job, right? Then when you get a nice job, you will make all this money. When you make all this money, then you can retire and be very happy. And then eventually you die and you think, wait a minute, what was the point of all that? You know, I can't make all this money. I've done all the right things. I got a PhD, I got all that education, and now I had to give it all up and start from scratch again and be reborn somewhere else. Right? And that's when you start to see that you are actually, it can feel so purposeful. I've been there, done that too. Everything feels so purposeful. But in the big picture of thing, it actually is completely pointless. You're just going round and around and around, doing the same thing again and again, roaming around without any sense of real direction. And this, I think, it comes out quite beautifully by the way it is translated here. Roaming and wandering on. Hindered by ignorance, right? Ignorance hinders you. You cannot see. And because you cannot see, you cannot make the right decisions. Ignorance blocks you from being able to do what is appropriate and what is right. So that is why ignorance is such a massive problem. Avidya is this thing which stops us from seeing things clearly. Delusion. Ignorance stops you, and you are fettered by craving. A fetter is a chain, right? A chain. You are chained to the world. You are chained to samsara. And craving is that chain which binds you, which glues you on to this perpetual wandering on, roaming around from life to life without purpose. The chain is craving here. Craving is a chain. Ignorance is what blinds you from understanding what's going on here. So very nice. It shows you these two very important concepts in Buddhism. They are so important because they are the real problem that we have to overcome. Avidya and tanha. They are, of course, very closely related to each other, right? We have tanha precisely because of avidya. So they are very closely related, but they are very important in this way. So that is the starting point of that sutta, a very beautiful little starting point. And this particular this particular phraseology is something that you see in many, many places. And then it says, write all the tears that you have shed through this long course because of separated by what is agreeable and united with what is disagreeable. And to be able to understand this, to be able to get some idea what actually rebirth really means for us, one of the good ways to think about this is to think about your own life in this life. And, you know, I don't know what your life has been like, but if it has been a bit like my life, then there has been a little bit of happiness, right? Sometimes kind of quite a bit of happiness, and other times quite a bit of suffering, right? Life is like this, up and downs. And I suspect that all of you are pretty much the same, unless you are very, very highly developed on the Buddhist path. And sometimes, if I ask myself, you know, my life has basically been quite good, right? I basically had all the good things that most people could want in this life. But if I look back on my life, despite having had a relatively good life, would I want to do it all over again? Not really. I wouldn't really want to do it all over again. There's been far too much suffering, having to grow up again through childhood, having to have all the problems and things that you have as an adolescent, right? Having to fight with my parents. Don't have to, but it just happens, right? You just fight with your parents. That's end of story. And then, you know, going through the kind of university years, studying hard, having troubles with girlfriends, right? Oh, that's lots of suffering. And all of these things, do I really want to go through all that again? And the answer is, if I had to do exactly the same thing again, it would be terrible going through exactly the same things again. The thing is that we hope that we have learned something, and by learning something, you don't have to do the same mistakes. But the problem is, and this is the problem with this idea of roaming around and wandering around in samsara, is that you end up doing the same mistakes again and again and again. Because most people don't get any wiser. Most people are not going anywhere. We just end up doing the same things again and again. So all the mistakes you have done in this life, all the suffering you've had in this life, you will do with a slight variations, you will do exactly the same thing again in your next life. And the next life, 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 right? 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. And after a while, as it says here, you feel revulsion. You feel horrified. I've had enough of this. I don't want to do these things again. And this is the idea. So just remember, remind yourself. Don't just think about the good times you had in this life. Remind yourself of the problems. Sometimes the problems we have, sometimes we suffer very seriously. I've had times in my life where the suffering has been very strong. Right? Okay, so you carry on and you get through it. But there are these times. People die. People pass away. As a monk, I feel very fortunate because I feel I have much more perspective on these things now. You know, my father was recently... I was recently told that he has terminal cancer, and these days it doesn't touch me so much anymore. Not because I'm a cold person, but because I realize this is the nature of life. There's not much to be sad about. This is what happens. And instead, just rejoice in having had a good father who lived a life well. So I'm very glad about that. But remember, this is the nature of things. It will happen again and again and again. Remember the suffering you've had. Don't just remember the happy times. And then this then becomes kind of starts to have an emotional impact on you. I really do not want to do these things again. Certainly not perpetually, endlessly into the future. And so this is really what this sutta is about. And that is why at the very end of the sutta, the Buddha says, because, bhikkhus, this is what is going on. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all formation. Revulsion is the word nibbida in Pali, and it is translated many different ways. Some people like to translate it into English as disenchantment. But as you can see, disenchantment in English doesn't mean very much. It doesn't mean very strong emotions. Disenchantment means, oh yeah, I'm not interested in that anymore, right? But if you read the sutta, it's much more than disenchantment. It's the feeling of, oh, enough. I don't want this. It's a feeling of being repelled, right? Of being pushed off samsara. And that's why I think revulsion is not a very bad translation. Perhaps revulsion, repulsion, aversion, perhaps, all of these terms. It's a very strong emotion. It's not an emotion which is defiled. It's not the defilement of being angry or anything like that. But it's a powerful emotion of being turned away from something. That is what we are seeing here. So that is the meaning of nibbida, as far as I can see. And there's also a few places in the suttas where that is very clear from the context. So you get repelled by all formations, sabbe sankara, all formations. Formations, sankara here means basically all phenomena, right? All constructed phenomena, all phenomena that have come into existence. And all phenomena that have come into existence basically is everything in the world. Everything in the world is a sankara. Everything has been created and formed, and it comes into existence as a consequence of cause and conditions. So you get repulsion from everything. Don't have anything to do with this world anymore. All rebirth, all of that stuff, you want to have an end of it. It is enough to become dispassionate towards all sankharas, right? First you get repulsion. You're repelled. You get pushed off. And as a consequence of being pushed away, you get dispassionate. Dispassion is the opposite of craving. So when you feel dispassion, it is like craving comes to an end. That's what dispassion means. Passion means you want things. It's similar to craving, similar to raga. This is viraga, opposite of raga. Raga stops. You have no interest anymore. And then, because of that, you become liberated from them. When dispassion sets in, you become liberated, which is vimutti. Liberation means the end of craving. And then, because of that, also the end of rebirth. And this last sequence I've just been reading out, nibbida, viraga, and vimutta, these are the same things that we saw. We didn't actually see that because I didn't read out the whole teaching to you. But the very first teaching we did on the psychology of meditation also ends in exactly those terms. So, as a matter of interest, I thought that it would be interesting to know. So that is the first sutta for you on rebirth and why rebirth is so powerful. I will continue to talk a little bit more about the idea of rebirth next time, tomorrow morning. But for now, that is enough. So I'll see you later on.